Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyes Wahib in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
South Sudan's new Government of National Unity held its first meeting Friday. The government includes men and women who were bitter rivals during the country's civil war, but must now work together if the country is to recover.
That's Jason Patinkin reporting from South Sudan's capital, Juba. Details next. Also, five people were shot dead last night in a bar in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. And South Africa's High Court ruled today to revisit corruption-related charges against President Jacob Zuma. We'll have these stories and lots this more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
The Voice of America.
Our top story this hour, South Sudan's new Government of National Unity held its first meeting today. The government includes men who were bitter rivals during the country's civil war, but must now work together if the country is to recover. Jason Patinkin reports from the capital, Juba.
After months of delays, politicians on opposing sides of South Sudan's two-and-a-half-year civil war have formed a new transitional government. In Juba Friday, President Salva Kiir swore in 30 cabinet ministers, 14 of whom were chosen by rebel leader-turned-vice president Riek Machar and other political groups. Formation of the government is a major step toward implementing the peace accord that Kiir and Machar signed 8 months ago under heavy international pressure. Machar told the Council of Ministers Friday it must bring an end to fighting to ensure economic recovery for the devastated nation.
To me, the challenge this council will face is the stabilization of the security. And we will not leave it to the security ministries. It should be the work of all of us.
President Kiir urged people to forget their grievances against each other for the sake of reconciliation.
My little knowledge about forgiveness tells me that when you forgive, you forget about it. This is all what we need.
The peace deal calls for the transitional government to enact economic and military reforms, organize elections within 30 months, and cooperate with a hybrid court that will try those accused of committing atrocities during the civil war. The African Union announced last year it would set up the court, adding that investigators found both sides were involved in acts of murder, torture, looting, and sexual violence. Most of the new cabinet ministers are well-known officials who have been on South Sudan's political scene for years, but serious doubts remain about the team peacefully working together. It was a political feud between Kiir and Machar that triggered the civil war in December 2013, 5 months after Kiir fired Machar as his vice president. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Juba.
Five people were shot dead last night in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. Police say four gunmen in trench coats walked into a bar and killed four civilians and a soldier. Violence in the capital has become commonplace. More than 500 people have been killed in the past year since President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office. The opposition called the move unconstitutional. About 260,000 people have fled the country. Next Tuesday, government and opposition officials are scheduled to meet in Arusha, Tanzania, to resume a peace dialogue. The UN Security Council has passed a resolution calling for the deployment of a police force to help quell the violence. South Africa's High Court ruled today that state prosecutors must revisit a 2009 decision to drop nearly 800 corruption-related charges against President Jacob Zuma. The move cranks up the political heat on Zuma amid a barrage of other corruption scandals. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The High Court's ruling could clear the way for President Jacob Zuma to again be charged with 783 counts of criminal offenses for alleged kickbacks in a 1999 state arms deal. Friday's ruling has caused jubilation from the country's opposition. Musi Maimane is leader of the Democratic Alliance, the party that approached the High Court with the case.
We welcome the fact that those charges must be continued and Jacob Zuma must have what he's always wanted, his day in court in the pursuit for accountability and the rule of law in South Africa.
The National Prosecuting Authority originally announced the charges in 2009, but the head of the NPA, Mokotete Mshe, then quickly dropped them, saying secret tape recordings had revealed that the timing of those charges was meant to stop Zuma from running for the office that year. The High Court said Friday that decision was irrational. This is just the latest in a recent string of scandals for Zuma. Opposition MPs tried to impeach him earlier this month after the Constitutional Court ordered Zuma to pay back some of the $20 million in public funds used for non-security-related upgrades to his private home. The spokesman for the ruling African National Congress Party, Zizigodwa, says Friday's ruling has no impact on Zuma's presidency.
The court reviewed the decision of the NPA, not whether the President Zuma is guilty or not. It does not arise. There are no charges against President Zuma. He remains innocent in terms of our Bill of Rights and the Constitution.
The decision has, however, increased the voices of those calling for Zuma to resign, both inside and outside the ANC. Zuma's office has not indicated if he will appeal the High Court decision. Experts say reinstating the charges could be a long legal process that could continue long after Zuma has left the presidency. He is currently serving his second and, by law, his final term, which finishes in 2019. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Italian and Austrian officials have very different opinions on how the migrant and refugee crisis should be handled. This week, Italy's foreign minister called Austria's plans to tighten border controls and build a fence at the Brenner Pass in the Alps not acceptable. Austrian officials say Italy needs to do much more to stop the northern flow of migrants. However, Italian and Austrian officials met yesterday to try to ease tensions, even though long-term solutions appear lacking. Most of the migrants and refugees are now entering Europe through Italy after crossing the Mediterranean from North Africa. Reporter Antonella Sferraza is following developments from Palermo, Sicily. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about Italian-Austrian relations on the issue.
In theory, Italy and Austria agreed on common terms in order to avoid closure of the Brenner Pass border. That's what the Italian Interior Minister Angelino Alfano said yesterday. A crisis and the closure of the Brenner Pass has so far been avoided, Alfano told a press conference after meeting with his Austrian counterpart Wolfgang Sobotka. But this is not a definitive solution. Alfano added that Italy has to work on it, and it will depend on Italy to make Austria not ordering the closure, and obviously on Austria to be reasonable on the issue. Alfano said that the Austrian plans were even more unjustified because the numbers of migrants passing from Italy to Austria were at their lowest levels for many years. At the same time, yesterday, the Austrian Interior Minister said no fence will be built. There will be no barriers, as it has been mistakenly reported, Sobotka told reporters. He added that if necessary, there will be more controls.
We had heard that Austria outlined plans to build a 370-meter-long fence at the Brenner Pass. So that information is not quite correct?
Yes, it is correct, because in the meantime, the Austrian Interior Minister said no fence will be built. But on Wednesday, the Austrian Parliament approved the new laws restricting the right of asylum that would allow authorities to turn away most migrants at the border if a state of emergency is invoked. And if a state of emergency is invoked, the Austrian authorities will have the possibility to build a fence on the border with Italy. So there is only an apparent calm after days of tensions between the two countries. analysts say it is only an armistice, also because the Austrian public opinion favors restriction and favors also the building of a fence. And we have seen the Austrian public opinion approach to the issue at the first round of a presidential election. As we know, Austria right-wing Freedom Party has beaten mainstream parties by a large majority who campaign against the migration and who is asking for the building of the fence to 37% of the votes. So the Austrian electoral result is widely seen as a further sign of growing disaffection with established parties in Europe struggling with ongoing refugee crisis. Not only in Austria, Angela Merkel has seen her high rates weaken, while in France, Marine Le Pen is expecting to make a strong showing next year election. And in Italy, Lega Nord and its anti-immigration policies gaining support. The conclusion is perhaps that the absence of a global solution to the current refugees crisis is fueling the rise of right-wing populist parties across Europe.
Now, if both Austria and Germany want Italy to do more about the migrants, what exactly does that mean? I mean, what does Italy have to do to satisfy Germany and Austria?
Well, to satisfy Germany and Austria, Italy probably should allocate all the refugees on its territory, which is obviously impossible for Italy. Italy, in fact, is pushing a plan to introduce an international cooperation, to introduce the NATO naval patrols of Libya in time for the peak summer season. But there is something that Italy is announcing, the Italian government, is to introduce the fingerprinting of migrants crossing in the Mediterranean as soon as they are picked up by rescue boats. Obviously, it is unclear how the policy will be implemented. Migrants are often picked up at sea in the dark and in a traumatized state, having almost drowned. So humanitarian organizations are condemning the idea.
Have you heard of any recent rescues on the Mediterranean?
Every day, hundreds of people are rescued in the Mediterranean. With the summer approaching, there will be an increase of number of migrants trying to cross the Mediterranean. So yesterday, hundreds of migrants have been rescued, and the day before, and it will be like this every day for all the summer.
That's reporter Antonella Sferraza from Palermo, Sicily. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. Media reports from Libya highlight the dangerous side of the migrant crisis. As many as 16 Egyptian migrants may have been killed in clashes with those smuggling people to Europe. Libya is the gathering place for many African migrants who hope to get to Europe by crossing the Mediterranean. Egypt's foreign ministry says the migrants, along with several Libyans, were killed recently in the town of Bani Walid. It's a transit point for migrants on their way to Tripoli. Estimates of the number of migrants and refugees in Libya hoping to get to Europe range from several hundred thousand to 1 million. You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. South Sudan's new government of national unity held its first meeting today. Five people were shot dead last night in a bar in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. And South Africa's High Court ruled today to revisit corruption-related charges against President Jacob Zuma. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. This week, Fulani herdsmen attacked and killed at least 20 farmers in southeastern Nigeria. The killings took place in the town of Ukupabi Nimbo in Enugu State. The Associated Press says a local Fulani leader blames the killings on what he called bad eggs from other states who have infiltrated the area. It was the latest in a series of clashes between herders and farmers in the northern and central parts of Nigeria. The Associated Press quotes President Muhammadu Buhari's office as saying security agencies are taking urgent steps to bring the perpetrators to justice. However, Nigeria's Punch newspaper reports the country's Nobel laureate, Wole Soyinka, blames the attacks on government inaction. He says the Buhari administration has failed to issue a tough statement condemning the killings. Soyinka says the government should disarm and prosecute any cattle herders caught with sophisticated firearms and confiscate their livestock. In just a few short years, the Tunisian people have negotiated a peaceful transfer of power from a transitional government to a democratically elected coalition government and have created space for civil society to flourish. However, the young democracy is facing serious economic challenges, including creating enough jobs for young people. Senior Middle East reporter Mohamed El-Shenawi examines the role of the international community in helping the Tunisian transition.
A recent study by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace has called for an international pragmatic approach to a successful Tunisian transition. The study envisions many levels of assistance, including financial aid, trade concessions, and a wide range of reforms by the Tunisian government. Marwan Muasher is the Vice President of Studies at Carnegie and a co-author of the study.
International players should intensify engagement with and assistance to Tunisia on urgent economic priorities. International partners should be prepared to increase and intensify their assistance, including through support to labor-intensive industries in Tunisia that can create jobs and visible results.
Muasher says Tunisia should look to the G7 summit in late May and a planned economic summit in Tunisia in the fall to get the needed economic assistance. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken says unless Tunisian challenges are met, the hope and the promise of this democratic transition will be at risk. He says Tunisians have right now to chart a much brighter future. Blinken adds that as the leaders of Tunisia strengthen their commitment to reform, the U.S. will continue to fill vital needs, provide critical know-how, and help cushion the near-term pain of change.
First, we are committed to help Tunisians consolidate their democratic gains as the greatest bulwark of long-term growth and stability, and an important counterpoint to those who believe that Islam is somehow incompatible with democracy. Second, we're helping to deliver on the promises of the revolution by improving the daily lives of Tunisians. With our technical assistance and support, Tunisia's leaders are enacting tough economic reforms and working to create an environment in which business can thrive.
Blinken says U.S. cooperation with Tunisia has never been more important to stop the threat posed by foreign terrorist fighters traveling to and from Iraq, Syria, and Libya. The United States has provided training to help modernize Tunisia's police, National Guard, and military to deal with security threats while respecting the rule of law. On the economic side, the United States has extended almost $1 billion in loan guarantees to the Tunisian government. Tunisian Minister of Development, Investment and International Cooperation, Yassine Brahim, has expressed his appreciation for the U.S. support, but says that if the United States would offer Tunisia a free trade agreement or FTA, foreign investment could help create jobs.
The FTA, if we start to discuss about it, that's also a signal for American investors to come to Tunisia. It's important for any country that make any FTA with the U.S. It means that really we have the environment that is sufficiently open and competitive to the U.S. investors. So that's, I think, one of the axes in terms of potential enhancement of the relationship in the short future, I hope, with the USA.
The Tunisian official says for the democratic transition to succeed, Tunisian youth must feel there will be economic opportunities for them. Mohammed Elshinawi, VOA News, Washington.
The future of Africa's elephants and their habitats is the focus of a three-day high-level summit in Kenya. Poaching has risen to alarming levels in recent years. About 100,000 African elephants were killed between 2010 and 2012. VOA's Jill Craig is attending the summit and has this report.
More than 200 people from the business, diplomatic, conservation, entertainment, philanthropic, and tourism communities attended the first day of Giants Club Summit talks near Mount Kenya on Friday. The goal is to find ways to stop the slaughter of Africa's elephants. And perhaps more importantly, for government leaders to flex their political muscle in support of the cause. Kenya's President Kenyatta gave the opening address.
The protection of giants therefore requires the combined wisdom of our elders as well as the hope of our youth. We have not abandoned our legacy and will not abandon our legacy to the whims of the market, but rather today we begin taking bold steps, indeed giant steps, which merit the praise and will merit the praise of our ancestors and which will inspire our own youth to recognize the intrinsic value of our national heritage.
Kenyatta's attendance at the summit, along with Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni and Gabon President Ali Bongo Ondimba, makes the event the highest level of its kind. Panelists Friday covered issues like the importance of properly training and motivating wildlife rangers, building a strong judiciary, and getting communities on board with conservation efforts. But Kenya Wildlife Service Chairman Richard Leakey emphasized that the market is key to the problem. The price of ivory is about $500 per kilogram, even more, he said, by the time it arrives at its destination.
And so my appeal is let's kill the market once and for all. Let's never again have ivory trade across international boundaries.
He urged all African countries with ivory stockpiles to destroy them. Kenya will torch its stockpile Saturday. Conservationists warn that elephants could face extinction in the wild if more is not done. There are more elephants dying either by natural or illegal means in Africa than there are being born. And the loss of forest elephants is even more striking than their savanna counterparts, with an estimated 70% loss of these animals in the last 10 years. In all, only about 400,000 African elephants remain. Officials unveiled elephant protection initiatives for Kenya, Uganda, Gabon, and Botswana at the summit, which include ramping up funding for frontline protection, improving intelligence, technological, and legal capabilities, building electrified fences, and setting up an endowment fund for protected areas, as well as other investments. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nanyuki, Kenya.
And in other news regarding wildlife, we have an update to a story we reported yesterday. A plane carrying 33 lions rescued from circuses in South America has begun the journey to a Southern African game sanctuary. 9 lions were loaded onto a plane in Colombia and 24 others were loaded in Peru. They're expected to arrive at 1:30 p.m. local time tomorrow at Imoya Big Cat Sanctuary in Limpopo, South Africa. They will join 8 other big cats there, including 2 tigers. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports and tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.